In the far future of the 41st millennium, an entire world can burn because of one man's greed and one heretic's ambition. The Kai Zhan. Uprising of 968 M41 is a stark example, a violent rebellion that turned a peaceful agri world into a war-torn hellscape. It began, fittingly, on a day of celebration, and ended after months of brutal urban warfare, leaving an unforgettable scar on imperial history. This is the story of how corruption, chaos, and courage collided on Kai Zhan in a dark chapter known as the Battle for Vogan. Kai Zhan was not a planet anyone expected to become a battlefield. It was a small oceanic agri-world in the Segmentum Obscurus, known mainly for its endless kelp farms and quiet prosperity. With over 98% of its surface covered by shallow seas, its single continent supported just 4 million people, hardly a thriving metropolis by imperial standards. Yet, this humble world was critically important. It produced vast quantities of food, nutritious but unglamorous kelp cakes, that fed billions in the nearby Cadian sector. Its location, a mere 75 light-years from Cadia, and along a major warp route in the Cadian Gate near the Eye of Terror, made it a linchpin in the region's logistics. In other words, Kai Zhan was the breadbasket, keeping the Imperium's frontline worlds nourished, and a tempting target for anyone wishing to disrupt the Imperium. For centuries, the planet quietly fulfilled its duty. Harvesting slimy green algae might not sound heroic, but those kelp cakes kept countless imperial citizens and soldiers alive. If you were stationed anywhere near Cadia, chances are you owed your breakfast to Kai Zhan's oceans. Under imperial rule, Kai Zhan was governed by a planetary governor and a network of family cartels who oversaw the massive seaweed harvesting operations. The Imperium demanded high tithes, both in food and in wealth, to support the planet's defense forces and infrastructure. A bit of corruption greased the wheels of local government, as it does nearly everywhere in the Imperium. A few missing thrones here and there, officials skimming a little off the top. Nothing outrageous. For a while, everyone could pretend the system worked. But about a decade before the uprising, things took a turn for the worse. Enter Planetary Governor Harakon Katalos, a man whose appetite for wealth made all his predecessors look positively austere. Cadulus had expensive tastes. Rumor had it even his golden bathtub had its own gold plating. To fund his lavish lifestyle, he dramatically increased taxes on the planet's producers and then promptly siphoned a large portion of that revenue into his personal coffers. The result? The cartels were squeezed, and they in turn squeezed their workers to make up the losses. Wages were slashed, prices soared, and basic upkeep, like adequately funding the planetary defense force, was neglected. In less than 10 years, Kai Zhan went from a stable, if mildly corrupt, backwater to a simmering cauldron of discontent. The workers were angry. The industrialists were resentful. The PDF was underpaid, under-equipped, and demoralized. And Governor Cadulus was too busy counting his money to notice any of it. Shockingly, bleeding your own planet dry turned out not to be a recipe for long-term stability. For opportunists lurking in the shadows, this was the perfect opening. At this point, meet the villain of our story, one charming and utterly corrupt individual named Von Guyen. Con artist extraordinaire might be a polite way to describe him. Treacherous scum might be more accurate. Von Guyen was a known swindler, wanted in multiple systems for impersonating ecclesiarchy officials and other petty frauds. During his travels, he had picked up something far worse than a criminal record. He'd been tainted by the warp and found new purpose as a devotee of the ruinous powers. In other words, he became a chaos cultist with a mission. And his next stop was the unhappy world of Kai Zhan. Arriving on this discontented planet, Von Guyen immediately set to work stirring the pot. He moved quietly among the population, organizing secret covens of like-minded malcontents and chaos worshippers. It's not hard to recruit followers when people are starving, oppressed, and furious at their leaders. Freedom from tyranny and corruption, that's what Von Guyen promised them. Throw off the yoke of the Imperium, he said, and all their woes would end. Of course, these were empty promises. The Dark Gods don't do charity work, but desperate people will believe a comforting lie over a bitter truth any day. Over months, if not years, Von Guyen built an extensive network of cult cells across Kai Jan, all plotting to claim the planet for themselves and their dark patrons. Even some members of the Planetary Defense Force were swept up in his rhetoric, willing to betray the Imperium out of disillusionment or the hope of personal gain. The stage was set. All Von Guyen needed was the right moment to strike. He didn't have to look far. Governor Catalus, in his supreme arrogance, had instituted an annual planet-wide holiday to celebrate his own birthday. Yes, you heard that right. The governor made everyone take a day off work to throw him parties and sing his praises. For Von Guyen, this was a golden opportunity. Half of the Kai Zan PDF would be off duty, many of them unarmed and unalert, enjoying the festivities. The planetary authorities would be distracted by parades and pomp. Security would be light in all the wrong places. If you were planning to overthrow the government, you could hardly script a better scenario. And so, on Catalus's birthday in 968 M41, while fireworks lit up the sky and the citizens feigned celebration of a man they quietly despised, all hell, quite literally, broke loose. It started in an instant. One moment, Vogan, the capital city of Kai Jan, was brimming with carnival crowds and decorative banners. The next, it erupted in gunfire, explosions, and screams. Von Guyen's rebellion was meticulously coordinated. Across the planet's lone continent, over 200 strategic targets were struck almost simultaneously. PDF barracks, communication nodes, armories, government offices, even the power generators and the spaceport, all were under attack by the rebels. Pre-positioned traitors within the PDF suddenly turned on their comrades, assassinating loyalist officers and sabotaging defenses. A hit list of Imperial officials was circulated among the cultists, and those unlucky names were swiftly hunted down, dragged from their homes or posts, and either captured or murdered in the streets. We can imagine Governor Catalus raising a gilded goblet at his birthday feast at the exact moment the doors to his palace banquet hall were kicked open by his own treacherous guards. In fact, Catalus didn't even get a chance to put up a fight. Unknown to him, Von Guyen had already subverted elements of the governor's household guard long before the first shot was fired. As the uprising commenced, the Chaos Agent strolled right into the heart of the governor's residence, a mighty fortress ironically dubbed the Palace of Peace, and with a snap of his fingers signaled his plan into action. In an instant, guards who had been standing at their posts like loyal sentinels revealed themselves as traitors. They turned their guns on their fellow sentries without warning. Within minutes, the palace was secured from the inside. Before Governor Catalus could even process what was happening, he was seized by his own security detail. Not a single lasbolt was fired in the palace's defense. In one fell swoop, Imperial authority on Kai Jan was decapitated. The planet's ruler became a prisoner of the rebellion. And considering how much the populace hated him by then, that was likely the final birthday surprise of his life. Once word spread that the mighty Palace of Peace had fallen without so much as a struggle, any organized loyalist resistance in Vogan began to collapse. The governor was out of the picture, the chain of command was in shambles, and panic set in among those still faithful to the Imperium. Chaos forces seize the moment and surge through the capital's streets, determined to take full control. Let's clarify who exactly the rebels were in this context, because it wasn't just a ragtag mob of peasants with pitchforks. Von Guyen had assembled a formidable war machine. Certainly, there were countless ordinary citizens who had thrown in their lot with the uprising, now turned into frenzied cultists, brandishing whatever weapons they could scrounge up. But alongside that rabble were professional traitors. Fully one-third of the Kaizen Planetary Defense Force had defected to the rebel cause. These turncoat PDF troops brought with them military-grade firepower, vehicles, and tactical know-how, limited as it might have been. To make matters worse, the rebellion had some very dangerous patrons. Approximately 100 Night Lords Chaos Space Marines, superhuman warriors dedicated to chaos, infamous for their cruelty and terror tactics, had joined the fight on Von Guyen's side. There were even reports that the rebels had managed to summon a handful of demons to further sow fear and destruction. In short, this was no mere peasant revolt. This was a well-planned insurgency with chaos backing, and it hit Kaizen like a sledgehammer. Picture the scene, mobs of chanting cultists flooding the streets, torching government buildings and shrines, and dragging screaming officials into the open. Traitor PDF squads turning the planet's own defense guns against loyalist holdouts, lobbing shells into any building flying the Imperial Aquila. And in the shadows, squads of Night Lords moving with lethal purpose, cutting down any organized resistance with bolter fire and chainsword, leaving horrific displays of flayed corpses to spread terror. The city of Vogan, Kaizen's heart, descended into anarchy and horror in a matter of hours. One of the first targets the rebels hit was Vogan's main genitorium, the central power plant that kept the lights on in the city. Taking out the power grid would plunge Vogan into darkness and confusion, a classic opening move for an urban insurrection. The loyalist PDF troops guarding the genitorium realized what was happening and fought desperately to hold off the attackers. When it became clear they were about to be overrun, those loyalists opted for a scorched earth approach. They rigged the generators with explosives rather than let them fall intact into rebel hands. Moments after the last loyal defenders were overwhelmed, the entire genitorium went up in a colossal explosion. The blast flattened everything within 200 yards, taking a chunk of the city's northern wall with it, and sent massive plumes of steam skyward as pipelines burst beneath the streets. In an instant, Vogan was cast into flickering darkness, the only illumination now coming from raging fires and sporadic emergency lumens. The rebels hadn't intended to blow up their own city's power supply, but the loyalists denied them this asset in a final act of defiance. Now the battlefield would be lit by fire and muzzle flash alone, adding to the chaos. Amid the citywide bedlam, the rebels even found time to begin celebrating their early successes, a hubris that the Imperials would exploit. With the Palace of Peace captured so swiftly and so many key points seized, old Von Guyen and his inner circle must have felt confident that victory was at hand. In fact, rebel commanders gathered for a victory feast in one of Vogan's grand hotels, the kind where off-world nobles once stayed on visits. As the story goes, they held a lavish banquet to toast the downfall of Imperial rule on Kaizen. But unbeknownst to them, Loyalist agents were not entirely beaten yet. An Imperial kill team, perhaps members of the Officio Assassinorum, or maybe just cunning guardsmen who slipped behind enemy lines, managed to infiltrate this celebration by posing as servants or coerced local staff. While the traitor officers reveled and raised glasses of vintage Amasek to their new freedom, the infiltrators quietly introduced a potent toxin into the celebratory wine. It was one toast too many. Within hours, several of the top rebel officers were dead or writhing on the marble floor in agony, their ambitious plans cut short by a dose of imperial cunning. The poisoning threw the rebel leadership into disarray precisely when they needed to be coordinated. What had been a tightly run coup suddenly became a headless snake for a critical span of time. It said that for nearly 12 hours, the traitor chain of command was paralyzed. They weren't even sure if the poisoning was an isolated act or the prelude to a larger counterstrike. Von Guyen himself survived. One imagines he was paranoid enough to have a food taster or simply lucky, but many of his lieutenants did not. In the wake of this, the rebels descended into paranoia. No one dared hold another grand meeting. Traitor officers started to move separately and in hiding, fearful that any gathering could be a trap. That window of confusion was all the remaining loyalists needed. In those hours, pockets of imperial forces and loyal citizens regrouped, fortified a few defensible positions, and generally prepared to make the rebels pay for every inch of ground. Despite setbacks like the poisoned banquet, by the end of that first day, the rebels still controlled most of Kai Jan. Outside the capital city, imperial rule was collapsing as well. One can assume that minor towns and outposts either joined the rebellion, fell into chaos, or were swiftly occupied by rebel detachments. The planet's sole spaceport, located in Vogan, had of course been an early target, and likely fell under rebel control quickly, ensuring the loyalists couldn't easily bring in off-world help or escape. It seemed briefly that the Imperium had lost an entire world in a single violent holiday. But even in this darkest hour, not everyone was prepared to roll over and die. On Kae Zom, two bastions of loyalist resistance stood defiant against the tide of chaos, and they would prove instrumental in turning the tables: the Adeptus Arbites Precinct House and the 102nd Cadian Regiment's headquarters. The Adeptus Arbites, the Imperium's lethal enforcers of law and order, do not surrender to mob rule. When Vogan descended into rebellion, the arbitrators of Kai Jan slammed shut the blast doors of their precinct fortress and prepared to uphold the Emperor's law with shotguns and shock mauls if necessary. The Arbites Precinct House was one of the most fortified structures in the city, aside from the Governor's Palace. Its grim gray facade bristled with firing slits, armored pillboxes, and heavy doors of plastile. It was situated on the western outskirts of Vogan, a fact that now became crucial. It meant the Arbites held a position at the city's edge, harder for rebels to encircle completely and potentially easier to relieve from outside. The rebels, flush with victory, could not ignore this thorn in their side. Soon, great hordes of cultists and traitor guardsmen swarmed around the Arbites compound, determined to smash the last symbol of imperial authority in the city. The fighting that broke out around the Arbites Precinct House was among the fiercest of the entire uprising. Execution Square, a broad plaza adjacent to the precinct, traditionally used by the Arbites for public executions of criminals, now lived up to its name in a far more chaotic way. Wave after wave of rebel attackers flooded the square, charging the precinct's towering gates and walls in a frenzy. The Arbites within, perhaps a few hundred strong at most, met them with disciplined fury. They had emplaced heavy bolters in the precinct's turrets and laid thick razor wire and mines on every approach. As the cultists surged forward, they were mowed down in droves. Shotgun blasts flared from firing ports, picking off leaders and rioters at close range. Arbitrators in black carapace armor manned heavy stubbers and grenade launchers at the walls, breaking up the assaults before they could reach touching distance. The first assault became a bloody pile of bodies choking the precinct's steps. Then the second assault came, and the third. The cultists' corpses began to form literal ramps up against the razor wire, so many had died in the same killing zones. It was insanity, a meat grinder of the highest order. Hundreds, Possibly thousands of rebels perished in short order trying to overrun the Arbites fortress, and still more kept coming, trampling their own dead in their zeal. But the Arbites were nothing if not resolute. These were judges and executioners who had been trained to feel neither fear nor mercy. They held their ground with ruthless efficiency, despite being vastly outnumbered. Soon the rebel commanders realized brute force alone wasn't working. The precinct house stood defiant amidst a ring of scorched gore and shattered cultist charges. Realizing that continued frontal assaults were futile and were only serving to deplete his own forces, von Guyen changed tactics. He ordered his forces to cease throwing themselves outright at the Arbites' stronghold. Instead, they surrounded it and settled into a siege, hoping to contain the Arbites and prevent them from interfering with rebel control elsewhere. If the Arbites couldn't be killed immediately, von Guyen intended to bottle them up and starve them out over time. However, anyone familiar with the Adeptus Arbites will know that they are not the sort to quietly sit and wait for death. The judges of Kai Zhan had a few moves of their own. Using access to the city's infrastructure, service tunnels, sewer systems, even an underground water purification network connected to their precinct, small teams of Arbites began conducting sorties outside their walls, under cover of darkness or amidst distracting firefights. These elite enforcers would emerge unexpectedly behind rebel lines, guns blazing. They ambushed rebel patrols, assassinated field leaders, and planted booby traps in buildings the cultists occupied. An Arbites squad might pop up from a maintenance hatch in the middle of a rebel-occupied hab block and unleash shotgun justice on a room full of unsuspecting heretics, disappearing before rebel reinforcements could react. These guerrilla-style counterattacks kept the rebels off balance and ensured that containing the Arbites was easier said than done. Execution Square, which the rebels had turned into their staging ground, would periodically erupt as the judges made their presence known with shock and awe before retreating to the safety of their citadel. In short, even besieged, the Arbites managed to terrorize the terrorists, giving the rebels a taste of their own medicine. Meanwhile, across the city on the eastern outskirts, the second loyalist holdout was fighting for its life. The Cadian 122nd Infantry Regiment, a proud unit of the Astra Militarum from the fortress world of Cadia, had been stationed on Kai Zhan as a garrison force. The 122nd, like any Cadian formation, was disciplined, well-trained, and extremely familiar with fighting chaos incursions. Cadia's proximity to the Eye of Terror meant every Cadian grew up battling something horrifying. When the uprising began, the Cadians' inherent vigilance paid off. In fact, the 122nd's commanding officer had harbored suspicions that trouble was brewing on Kai Zhan. Unsettled by the rising unrest and maybe tipped off by some minor incident, he had quietly kept a significant portion of his regiment on alert, even during the governor's holiday celebrations. So, unlike the local PDF, the Cadian troops were not entirely caught with their pants down. When the chaos erupted, roughly one-third of the regiment was already geared up and ready, and many others were within reach of their weapons. This preparation saved the regiment from being massacred in the initial coup. As Vogan fell into chaos around them, the Cadians swiftly regrouped at their predetermined rally point, the regimental headquarters compound, located on the city's eastern edge. This HQ was effectively a fortified camp, likely consisting of barracks, motor pools, and defensive perimeters that the guards set up for themselves. Once it became clear that the governor's palace and most of the city were lost, the 122nd pulled back to secure their own base. They dug in with typical Cadian efficiency, setting up sandbags and barricades, establishing overlapping fields of fire, deploying whatever heavy weapons they had on hand. Any loyal elements of the local PDF or fleeing officials who could reach them were absorbed into the defenses. Before long, the rebel tide crashed against this second rock of resistance. The siege of the 122nd Cadian HQ was every bit as brutal as the Arbites stand on the opposite side of town. The rebels, emboldened by early victories, were eager to wipe out this last pocket of Imperial Guard. They assaulted the compound repeatedly. Enormous mobs of cultists rushed forward, only to be met with disciplined volleys of lasergun fire. The Cadians might have been heavily outnumbered, but these were professional soldiers, survivors of countless drills and possibly real battles elsewhere. Firing in well-coordinated ranks, they scythed down the charging hordes with grim precision. When the traitors tried using captured PDF-armored vehicles to smash into the perimeter, the guard responded with crack missiles and melta guns, turning those makeshift battering rams into flaming wrecks. A few Lehman Russ tanks and armored personnel carriers from the 122nd's motor pool were brought to bear as well. Their heavy turrets boomed, and machine guns raked across advancing lines of rebels, further blunting the attack. Despite their stout defense, the situation for the 122nd was dire. They were heavily outnumbered and cut off, and the rebels were determined. Casualties mounted among the guardsmen. Later accounts would note that by the end of the first full day of battle, only half a dozen men in the entire 122nd remained completely uninjured. Virtually every surviving Cadian had shed blood, if not their own, certainly the enemy's, during the fighting. Many had been wounded, some multiple times, and continued to fight on, bandaged and blood-soaked. The compound itself was pockmarked with craters and littered with the bodies of the fallen, enemy and friend alike. Still, every time a breach was blasted through the outer defenses, the Cadians rallied and sealed it. Every time a cultist banner appeared atop a rubble pile, a Cadian marksman picked off its bearer and sent the heretic standard tumbling. Frustrated by the stalled assaults, the rebels escalated their efforts against the 122nd. They brought up heavy artillery, likely captured Imperial guns or makeshift rocket launchers, and began to pound the Cadian positions relentlessly. Explosions rocked the compound day and night, collapsing guard towers and shredding trenches. Under this cover of constant shelling, von Guyen sent in his elite shock troops, the Night Lords. Under cover of darkness and chaos, squads of Night Lords Chaos Space Marines breached the perimeter in several places, spearheading new waves of attackers. Now the Cadians faced a terrifying challenge, towering Chaos Marines in midnight blue armor, moving with supernatural speed and strength, crashing into their defensive lines. The close quarters fighting that erupted was nothing short of nightmarish. The Night Lords carried blades and claws crackling with energy, and they showed no mercy, carving through Loyalist defenders with sadistic glee, even as gunfire sparked off their power armor. But the 122nd did not break. These guardsmen were Cadian, born and bred. If they were going to die, they'd make the enemy pay tenfold. Small squads of guardsmen counterattacked the Chaos Marines in desperate firefights within the compound's ruins. They used plasma guns, grenade launchers, even satchel charges at point-blank range to bring down these behemoths. In one corner, a veteran sergeant might tackle a Night Lord in brutal hand-to-hand combat, while his squad mates concentrated last fire on the traitor's helmet visors. In another, a knocked-out Chimera transport was turned into an impromptu fortress, guardsmen firing from its hatches to cover comrades moving between broken walls. It was chaotic, ferocious, and costly on both sides. For every Cadian that fell, two or three cultists were likely slain, but sheer numbers and the presence of the Chaos Marines were pushing the Loyalists to their limits. After hours of bitter fighting through day and night, the rebels still could not completely overrun the 122nd's HQ. Parts of the outer defenses were in ruins, and at times the traitors had penetrated deep into the compound, but the Cadians never lost their core foothold. By perhaps the second dawn of the uprising, the 122nd still held a semblance of a line, albeit a much smaller and battered one. The rebels had taken gruesome losses trying to eliminate them, and they began to reconsider their approach. Much like at the Arbites precinct, von Guyen saw that direct assaults on the Cadian redoubt were costing him too dearly. So he changed strategy there as well. The rebels settled into a siege and containment around the 122nd headquarters. They kept the pressure on, constant harassment, sniper fire, and occasional probing attacks, but stopped throwing huge waves into the meat grinder. The goal was to pin the Cadians in place, prevent any breakout or effective action from them, and simply wait for them to succumb to hunger, exhaustion, or despair. By the end of the second day, the situation on Kai Jan was something like this. The rebels controlled nearly the entire planet and city, except for two small but stubborn pockets on the outskirts of Vogan, one to the west, one to the east, where loyal Imperial forces, the Arbites, and the Cadian 122nd, still held out. These loyalists were surrounded and outnumbered, but unyielding. The rebels had momentum but had stalled at these last bastions. A sort of uneasy pause fell over the war, as if both sides were catching their breath. Little did von Guyen realize that pause would cost him everything, because help for the loyalists was already on the way. Kai Jan's pleas for aid had not gone unheard. Amid the chaos of day one, someone, perhaps an astropath deep in the Arbites precinct's basement, or a Vox officer at the Cadian HQ, managed to send a distress call into the void. Given Kai Jan's strategic value and proximity to major Imperial military hubs like Cadia, the response was swift by Imperial standards. Barely 2 days into the uprising, the Imperium had rallied a relief force. On the third day of the rebellion, salvation arrived from the sky. Through the clouded heavens came dropships, landers, and military craft bearing the grim green and gray livery of the Astra Militarum and the proud heraldry of the Adeptus Astartes. The Emperor had dispatched the cavalry. Multiple regiments of the Imperial Guard translated from warp into the system, escorted by elements of the Imperial Navy, and made haste to deploy on the surface. Among them were the seasoned troops of the Cadian 9th Infantry Regiment and the Cadian 7th Infantry Regiment, as well as the armored might of the Cadian 3rd Heavy Tank Regiment, entire companies of Lehman Russ battle tanks and armored vehicles, ready to reclaim the streets of Vogan. And they were not alone. Answering the call was an elite strike force from the Imperial Fists Space Marine chapter. The Imperial Fists sent two whole companies of their chapter, the 5th Company and the 9th Company, to join the fight. These Space Marines, clad in their unmistakable yellow power armor and renowned for their expertise in siege warfare, would prove invaluable in the coming battle. For the beleaguered loyalists on the ground, the arrival of these reinforcements was nothing short of a miracle. At the start of day three, the Arbites and the survivors of the 122nd had likely been preparing for a final, doomed last stand. They were exhausted, low on ammunition, and completely surrounded. Then, like wrathful angels, the Emperor's reinforcements descended. The fresh Imperial forces landed at the periphery of Vogan, outside the rebel-held city, and quickly made contact with the two holdouts. Because the Arbites precinct and the Cadian HQ were both on the outskirts, the relief forces didn't have to punch straight through the city to reach their comrades. They could land relatively close and fight their way into the defensive perimeters of those compounds. One imagines the scene as dropships kicking up dust near the Arbites precinct, disgorging squads of Cadian shock troopers who rush forward to link up with the astonished judges, or columns of Cadian tanks rolling down an arterial road to the 122nd's compound, guns blazing at any rebels who dared stand in their way. The sieges that von Guyen had imposed were suddenly broken from the outside. By the afternoon of the third day, the loyalist strong points were relieved. Battered arbitrators and guardsmen emerged from their fortifications to greet their saviors, and perhaps to point out which direction to aim all those reinforcements for maximum effect. Wasting no time, the Imperial command on the scene, now bolstered by high-ranking Cadian officers and an Imperial Fists captain or two, ordered an immediate counteroffensive to retake Vogan and crush the uprising. The Loyalists now had the numbers, the firepower, and even Space Marine support. The equation had flipped. All those cultists and traitor guards who had been so flush with victory suddenly found themselves facing the fury of the Emperor's vengeance head-on. What followed were 3 weeks of some of the most intense urban combat imaginable. With the two beachheads, Arbeit's precinct in the west, Guard HQ in the east, secured, Imperial forces began pushing into the city from both sides, determined to meet in the middle and squeeze the rebellion into oblivion. The operation essentially became a city-wide pincer movement, with the ultimate goal of recapturing the Palace of Peace at the center. Urban warfare is notoriously slow, brutal, and costly, and the Battle of Vogan was no exception. The moment the Imperial forces advanced into the dense city blocks, they were met with a maze of rubble, booby traps, and desperate enemy fighters. Every block had to be taken by force, often house by house, room by room. The Cadian regiments, fighting alongside local loyalist PDF remnants, and the indomitable Arbites, found themselves in a grind of attrition. Tanks from the 3rd Heavy Tank Regiment roared down boulevards, their heavy treads crushing burnt-out cars and debris, while their turrets sent high-explosive shells thundering into buildings that had been converted into rebel strongpoints. Behind the tanks came squads of guardsmen, utilizing the armored behemoths as moving cover, until enemy fire or a blocked street forced them to dismount and proceed on foot. The city itself became a patchwork of micro-battlefields. Key intersections and plazas were fiercely contested. One boulevard on the south side of the city, leading from the old law courts toward the city center, earned the nickname Sniper's Alley. It turned out the rebels had positioned marksmen and at least one chaos-tainted Vindicar sniper, if rumors are true, in the upper floors of HAB blocks and administrative towers along that stretch. Any Imperial trooper or vehicle trying to cross the open street would be met with a lethal shot from some unseen nest. The name Sniper's Alley quickly stuck, and crossing that gauntlet became a special kind of nightmare for the guardsmen, until the Imperial Fists took it upon themselves to cleanse those sniper roosts one by one. It was slow, perilous work, with Space Marines stalking through shattered skyscraper halls to hunt expert killers hidden in the shadows. The Imperial Fists' Space Marines, for their part, proved instrumental wherever the fighting was thickest. These transhuman warriors moved methodically through Vogan, often spearheading assaults on the toughest objectives. A typical engagement might see a squad of Imperial Fists breaching the fortified entrance of a municipal building that rebels had turned into a bunker, storming in with bolt guns roaring and chainswords revving, clearing it floor by floor, while terrified cultists fought back with scavenged weapons and dark prayers. When the Fists encountered the Night Lords, the battle escalated into something truly ferocious. Here were two forces of Adeptus Astartes, loyalist and traitor, clashing in the narrow confines of hallways and alleys. Witnesses would later describe hearing blood-chilling war cries and seeing flashes of energy weapons and power claws in the gloom as these superhuman opponents dueled amidst the ruins. The Night Lords, true to their legacy, tried to use fear and terror tactics even in direct combat. Sudden ambushes, grisly tricks like hanging flayed bodies as psychological warfare. But the Imperial fists are made of stern stuff, utterly fearless and unwavering. Bit by bit, they began to turn the terror back on its source. Every Night Lord felled by a chainsword or melted by a plasma blast showed the rebels that these loyalists would not be cowed. The rebels, for their part, did not simply roll over. This was their endgame, and they fought tenaciously for every street and structure. They had had time, in those days of siege, to prepare defensive positions throughout Vogan. Whole thoroughfares were blocked by makeshift barricades of wrecked ground cars, sandbags, and rubble. Buildings were turned into fortresses with firing slits knocked in walls and heavy weapons positioned to cover killing fields. The traitor PDF, being local, knew the terrain intimately, and they used that knowledge. They set traps everywhere. Entire buildings were wired to explode or collapse on advancing Imperial squads. Hidden minefields were laid in alleys, and innumerable improvised explosive devices awaited incautious troops. The cultists might not have had the discipline of the guard, but they made up for it with fanaticism and sheer creativity in causing mayhem. Some parts of the city saw particularly notable battles. For example, the twin defense laser towers on Gibbet Hill, an old fortified island just outside the city's northeast walls, were hotly contested. Those towers, armed with anti-orbital laser batteries, had a commanding line of sight over much of Vogan. If controlled by the rebels, they could bombard Imperial positions or even threaten orbiting craft. If taken by the Imperials, they would provide a valuable firebase. Both sides knew this, and so a seesaw battle was fought over Gibbet Hill's silos. The high ground changed hands multiple times. At one point, the rebels managed to fire the defense lasers into the city, collapsing entire hab blocks occupied by advancing guard units. The guard, in turn, retaliated with airstrikes from Navy flyers to soften the hill, followed by an assault by the Imperial fists. By the end of the campaign, virtually nothing was left of the original installation. The hill was littered with craters and the smoking hulks of destroyed gun emplacements, but it was firmly in Imperial hands, eliminating that threat. Inside the city, places of civic pride and commerce became charnel houses. The grand mercantile district, once full of markets and counting houses, turned into a war zone of street barricades and burning trade halls. The pleasure district, a neighborhood of theaters and pleasure houses that had seen its share of decadence under Cadulus's regime, became a rebel red light stronghold. Some of Von Guyen's cult leaders had holed up in the richly appointed hotels there, at least until the Imperial kill team's poisoning incident made them skittish. The Imperial forces eventually fought through these areas too, discovering evidence of horrific debauchery and slaughter left by the cultists, macabre festivals of blood that spoke to the chaos influence driving the rebellion. Not all the carnage in Vogan, however, was simply loyalist versus rebel. The uprising had uncorked social hatreds that had simmered for years under Cadulus's misrule. Now those hatreds boiled over uncontrollably, and even the arrival of Imperial reinforcements didn't immediately put a lid on them. In the wealthy cartel districts, for instance, many opulent family mansions had already been looted and occupied by angry workers when the guard arrived. These squatters considered the estates their rightful spoils after years of exploitation. When Imperial soldiers came marching in to secure these areas, they were met not with cheers but with gunshots and crude bombs from the new owners. As far as these citizen militants were concerned, anyone trying to take away their hard-won loot, even Imperial Guard, was an enemy. This led to tragic clashes where guardsmen had to fight and kill groups of civilians who, though not chaos worshippers, had been swept up in the anarchy and wouldn't lay down arms. Clearing out these pockets of lawlessness delayed the main advance and added an ugly layer of moral complexity to the war. What were the liberators to one citizen were oppressors to another? In the end, the guard did what they had to do. They pacified the areas by force, as gently as possible, but by force nonetheless. It was either that or leave armed gangs free to stab them in the back while they confronted the true traitors. Similarly, in the ruined hab blocks on the city outskirts, the Imperial forces encountered bands of completely feral survivors. These were ordinary people, men, women, entire families, whose homes had been destroyed in the shelling and who had lived through days of nightmare. Many were half mad with fear, hunger, or the whispers of chaos. They trusted no one, hated both the rebels for causing the destruction and the Imperials for bombarding the city to take it back. As the Guard and Arbites swept through these rubble zones, they sometimes found themselves under attack by ragged mobs of civilians wielding kitchen knives or scavenged laser guns, fighting for scraps of food or simply out of delirious aggression. In one infamous anecdote from the battle, a lone Cadian sentry who became separated from his squad was set upon by desperate looters and literally beaten to death with pipes and fists. All because he had a pack of rations and, ironically, a sturdy pair of boots. It underscored the absolute chaos that had engulfed Vogan. When society breaks down, everyone becomes a potential threat. The Imperium was learning that restoring order could be just as bloody as defeating the initial rebellion. Despite all these challenges, the momentum was now firmly on the Imperium's side. Inch by inch, day by day, the Loyalist forces reclaimed ground. They paid for every intersection in blood, but they did take them. Slowly, the noose tightened around the center of the city. The rebels were forced to retreat further inward, compressing their lines. After 3 weeks of continuous fighting, the Imperials had retaken roughly 3/4 of Vogan. The areas still under rebel control were essentially those immediately surrounding the Palace of Peace, the Governor's Palace and its grounds, plus a few adjacent districts that the rebels had heavily fortified as their last stand zones. Von Gajen and his followers were now cornered in the very heart of the city they had once completely dominated. But they were not defeated yet. As the Imperials closed in, the battle entered a new phase. The siege of the Palace of Peace. The irony was palpable. The Loyalists now had to assault the same fortress that the rebels had captured in the war's opening act. Only now it was far more defensible, because the rebels had spent weeks turning the palace and its surroundings into a veritable citadel of chaos. The Palace of Peace, what a name considering the carnage around it, was built on high ground in central Vogan, with broad avenues, now devastated, radiating from it. The rebels controlled perhaps a kilometer radius around the palace by this stage, and they fortified this zone extensively. Every street leading in became a choke point bristling with barricades, makeshift bunkers, and firing positions. The palace itself was a massive fortress, originally designed to withstand serious assaults. Its outer walls were meters thick, reinforced with ceramite and shielded by void generators, though whether those still functioned after all this, who knows? Large courtyards and kill zones lay before its gates. The narrow, rubble-strewn streets leading to the palace prevented the Imperial Guard from simply driving their tank companies straight up to the walls. The armor had to halt at a distance, providing fire support from safer positions. This final stronghold was essentially a medieval siege in the midst of a ruined modern city, and so the conflict ground to a stalemate once more, albeit on a much smaller patch of land. The Imperial Fists took charge of siege operations, this being exactly the kind of challenge they excel at. Under their command, the Imperial forces encircled the palace enclave and began systematic siege tactics. Artillery was brought in as close as possible and kept up a near-constant bombardment day and night, hammering the rebel positions. The thunder of guns became a grim lullaby for everyone in Vogan. No one within miles could sleep without feeling the ground tremble. Sappers tried to dig trenches and tunnels to advance closer under cover, but the rebels would sortie at night or use their own sorcerous means to disrupt these efforts. Snipers on both sides ensured that exposing one's head above a trench during daylight was a death sentence. Inside the palace perimeter, conditions for the rebels must have been hellish as well. With their backs to the wall, the cultists and traitor PDF fought with a manic fervor. They still had some heavy weapons, likely stockpiles of Lascannons or autocannons, and they used them to snipe at Imperial siege lines. They also used what other resources they had. For instance, there were said to be underground geothermal vents near the palace, and the rebels jerry-rigged power generators off of them to keep their lights on and weapons charged after the city's main grid was lost. One lucky break for the Imperials. Early in the counterattack, a Cadian battalion had located and destroyed one of these makeshift generator sites, though at a horrific cost of life, forcing the rebels to keep relocating their power sources. For 3 long months, the siege dragged on. This was no quick, glorious charge. It was trench warfare, progressive and grinding. Every day, the loyalists would inch a few meters closer to the palace walls, securing one more ruined building or blasting a new breach barricade. Every night, the rebels would probe the lines, perhaps launching fanatical sorties led by the remaining Chaos Space Marines to push the attackers back a bit, or infiltrators slipping out to sow mines and traps anew. The weather likely added to the misery. Kai Zhan's shallow oceans meant the air was probably humid and chilly at night, with mist rolling in off the water, mixing with the smoke and ash of the ruined city to create a clammy haze. Disease and infection no doubt started to spread among the exhausted troops on both sides. The Arbites, Medicae, and Guard medics working overtime to stave off trench fevers and worse. Despite the hardships, the Imperial resolve never wavered. They would retake that palace, no matter the cost. The Imperial Fists, master planners of siegecraft, orchestrated a final concentrated assault once they judged the moment right. By then, the rebel forces had been whittled down severely. Starvation, constant bombardment, and the attrition of countless skirmishes had reduced the once massive cultist horde to a hardened core of survivors. Perhaps a few thousand remained alive and armed inside the palace compound, including the last of the Night Lords and the most fanatical cult leaders. The impasse was finally broken by a carefully orchestrated breach. After weeks of sappers tunneling and placing charges, and likely sacrificing many engineers to counter-tunneling efforts and sabotage, a section of the outer palace wall was blasted open. Simultaneously, Imperial artillery concentrated all fire on one of the main gates, weakening it enough that a few demolition teams from the Imperial Fists could rush forward under covering fire and detonate melta bombs at its base. In a deafening blast, a portion of the gate and wall crumbled. The moment had come. The final assault on the Palace of Peace began with the Imperial Fists leading the charge. They advanced with fearless determination, storm shields raised and holy bolt guns firing as the gap in the walls billowed dust and smoke. The rebel defenders threw everything they had left at the breach. Gunfire, grenades, makeshift bombs, even mutant berserkers they'd been holding in reserve. It wasn't enough. The Astartes punched through, creating a secure lodgment inside the walls. Right on their heels were the Cadian guardsmen and the vengeful Arbites. The battle inside the palace grounds was apocalyptic. The once beautiful courtyards and gardens were now cratered killing fields strewn with wreckage. The rebels, knowing this was truly the end, fought with the frenzy of the damned. The last dozen or so night lords, their armor scarred and blackened, gathered for a final stand around their chaos banners. They clashed with the imperial fists in vicious melee, chainswords snarling, lightning claws crackling. One by one, these chaos space marines fell, but not without dragging several imperial heroes down with them. Amidst the fountains and colonnades of the palace approach, hand-to-hand fighting erupted on a scale rarely seen. Guardsmen bayoneted cultists in the shadow of marble statues. Arbite's officers swung power mauls to shatter the skulls of traitor PDF troopers. Wounded men from both sides grappled and stabbed each other, while flames and tracers lit the night. No quarter was given. The fury of months of war was unleashed on the surviving rebels. By this point, mercy was a concept long since burned away. The Arbites, in particular, were hungry to dispense justice, and they did so mercilessly. At Imperial command, once the breach was secure, the Adeptus Arbites were given the honor of spearheading the last push inside the palace proper. These lawbringers had, after all, been fighting since the first moments of the uprising. It was only fitting that they be the ones to put the final period on the saga. In tight formations, Arbites squads advanced through the ornate hallways and chambers of the palace. Many of these halls were already damaged by shelling, chandeliers fallen, murals blackened by soot. The rebels had turned the place into a Gothic battlefield, barricading throne room doors with overturned banquet tables, creating impromptu bunkers behind stacks of looted gold and art, ironic shields for traitors to hide behind. It didn't save them. The Arbites cleared room after room with shock and awe tactics. They tossed stun grenades or tear gas into defended rooms, then swept in behind armored shields, shotgunning any dazed cultist who still held a weapon. They announced their arrival with amplified voices. "The Emperor's law is here. Surrender or die." But by this point, surrender wasn't truly being accepted. It was die or die for the heretics. And they died in droves. Somewhere in this frenzy, von Guyen, the architect of the uprising, met his end. Accounts differ on the exact detail. One story suggests that von Guyen, in a final act of cowardice, tried to slip away through a secret tunnel with a handful of bodyguards, only to be intercepted by an Arbites kill team in the lower dungeons. A shotgun blast to the gut ended his dreams of glory for good. Another version holds that von Guyen stood his ground in the palace's sanctum, wielding a stolen power sword and screaming curses until an Imperial Fists veteran sergeant clove him in twain with a chainsword. Either way, it's certain that von Guyen did not escape and did not survive. The exact manner of his death is almost academic. When the Palace of Peace fell, he fell with it, as did every last traitor who had defiled Kai Jan. When the guns finally fell silent and the last screams faded, the Kai Jan uprising was over. Vogan was retaken. The Imperial Aquila was raised once more over the smoking ruins of the Palace of Peace. Not one rebel was left alive within the city. Those who hadn't been killed in battle were summarily executed in the aftermath by the Arbites' firing squads, their charred bodies added to the monumental funeral pyres that now dotted the devastated streets. The cost of this victory was staggering. What had started as a prosperous, if discontented, imperial world had been reduced to a charnel house. The city of Vogan was devastated beyond recognition. Entire districts were flattened, historic buildings and infrastructure lay in ruins. The civilian population, those 4 million souls who once inhabited Kai Jan's peaceful coastlines, had suffered horribly. Casualties among the populace were uncountable. Many tens of thousands were dead from the fighting, and countless others injured or psychologically scarred by the nightmare they had lived through. The loyalist military forces, too, paid a heavy price. The Cadian 122nd Regiment was a shadow of its former self. They had held the line and taken back the city, but at tremendous cost in lives. Other Cadian regiments and local PDF units also bled mightily in those streets. Even the victorious Imperial Fists left a number of their brethren entombed on Kai Jan, their gene seed hopefully recovered for the chapter's future. Yet, for all that, the Imperium had prevailed. Kai Jan was back under the Emperor's control. The very strategic importance that made it worth fighting over would also ensure it was rebuilt. The supply of food to the Cadian sector would resume, though one imagines there might have been a short-term famine scare until Kai Zahn's sea farms got running again. A new planetary governor would be appointed, hopefully a wiser and less corrupt one. One suspects the Administratum would be very careful with Kai Zahn's next overseer, given what happened. The surviving population would be sternly reminded of their duty and likely subjected to intense inquisitorial scrutiny to root out any lingering taint of chaos. For those who fought and survived, the Battle of Vogon would never be forgotten. Veterans would recount the sheer confusion and savagery of the urban meat grinder. One famous first-hand account came from a veteran sergeant, Hessel of the Cadian 122nd. He described the battle for Vogon thus: "What I remember most about the fight was the confusion and the colossal scale of death. We fought like heroes, as if each building that had even one guardsman inside was a fortress against the enemy. Every soldier, fighting in a basement or under the stairs, stood his ground alone and accomplished his task on his own. In city fighting, a soldier has to be his own general. He needs correct guidance and the trust of his officers. On Vogon we had neither, and how we survived was a miracle." Those words capture the desperate, decentralized nature of the conflict. Small groups and individuals holding out on sheer will and initiative when larger command structures failed in the chaos. And what of the instigators of this nightmare? Governor Cadulus, the man whose greed lit the fuse, had long since met his end by the time the smoke cleared. He was taken prisoner in the uprising's first moments. By most accounts, the rebels wasted little time in exacting revenge on him. It's believed Cadulus was either executed outright by von Guyenne's order, perhaps sacrificed in some blasphemous ritual to appease the dark gods, or torn apart by a vengeful mob of the very workers he had impoverished. In any case, he didn't live to see the Imperium restore order. One might call it poetic justice. Cadulus's avarice sparked a conflagration that consumed him, first of all. In the aftermath, as the Imperium tightened its grip once more on Kai Jan, there would be no celebration, only grim satisfaction and weary relief. The objective had been achieved. The rebellion was crushed by the Imperium's harsh calculus. That meant success, regardless of the ruinous cost. The Administratum would record it as a victory, and life on Kai Jan, such as it was, would slowly grind on. The planet would be cleaned up, mass graves dug for the fallen, industries rebuilt. The survivors would be put back to work, harvesting kelp, as they always had, under the watchful eye of a reinforced garrison, and likely an inquisitor or two sniffing around for any remaining corruption. For the wider Imperium, the Kai Jan uprising became a cautionary tale. It showed how dangerously fast a seemingly loyal world could fall if rot and resentment were allowed to fester, especially in a critical location so close to the Eye of Terror. No doubt Imperial authorities used the example of Kai Jan to threaten other planetary governors. "Don't neglect your duties, or you might have a Kai Jan situation on your hands." Of course, whether those in power truly learned the lesson is another matter. The Imperium is not known for its capacity to change, even when faced with clear evidence of what not to do. there would be other rebellions in other places, driven by the same toxic mix of internal corruption and external manipulation. But at least on Kaizhan, for one rare instance, the outcome, costly and pyrrhic as it was, favored the Imperium in the end. As the dust settled, the Imperium could take grim pride in the fact that they had snatched this world back from the brink of damnation. The Emperor's light was restored on Kaizhan, and the forces of chaos were denied a prize on the Imperium's doorstep. The loyal soldiers and citizens who gave their lives had not died in vain. Their sacrifice ensured that Kaizhan would continue to serve the Imperium, feeding the armies of Kadia and standing as a bulwark, albeit a scarred one, against the encroaching darkness. Perhaps the most sobering thought of all when reflecting on the Kaizhan uprising is that none of it ever needed to happen. Had Governor Cadulus been a just ruler instead of a corrupt parasite, had the Imperial administration addressed the people's grievances instead of exacerbating them, von Guyen might never have found fertile ground for his poison. The rebellion was born as much from misrule as from chaos. It's a harsh lesson that the Imperium, in its authoritarian might, rarely heeds, that internal rot can weaken a world as surely as any external enemy. But in the grim darkness of the far future, such introspection is a luxury. The Imperium moves on to the next crisis, the next war, bearing its scars but seldom changing its ways. Kaizhan's story, then, is a tragedy and a triumph all at once. A peaceful world was nearly destroyed from within, saved only by immense feats of valor and rivers of blood. A rebellion fueled by the worst of human greed, and chaos's seduction was put down by the best of human courage and imperial resolve. The cost was monstrous, but on Kaizhan, as on countless worlds, that is the price the Imperium of Man is willing to pay for survival. In the end, the rebellion was crushed, the planet was retaken, and life, in whatever fragile form it still existed, went on under the Emperor's rule. Thus ends the tale of the Kaizhan Uprising, a dark chapter of rebellion, retribution, and the brutal realities of the 41st millennium. It serves as a stark reminder that the line between order and chaos is perilously thin, and that even in victory, the Imperium's burdens are heavy. On Kaizhan, that line held, barely. The world that once fed the Cadian sector with its harvests almost choked on the bitter fruits of treachery, but ultimately loyalty and discipline prevailed over heresy and anarchy. It was a victory, dearly bought and deeply paid for, the only kind of victory humanity ever seems to get in the grim darkness of the far future.